Hey, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lamberth. Today is Sunday, December 13th, 2020. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and even Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. Give it a 5-star review. Let everybody know why you like it, because it'll make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now on Twitter at Chris Lamberth. This is episode 470. I have a super special return guest. You know her. You love her. It's Aisha Harris from NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm going to share that conversation that I had with her, with you, in a bit. I just wanted to say a couple things. Sign up for the Patreon, $3 a month. You get bonus content. There's hours and hours of bonus content from this show with me talking about stuff and things, and sometimes talking with other people about stuff and things. Another thing, Failed Running Back, my debut stand-up comedy album, EP, whatever you want to call it. That's available to listen and download wherever you listen and download and stream music. You can also get me telling yuck yucks, premium yuck yucks on Failed Running Back. So that's available to you too. So let's get to Aisha Harris. I had been trying to schedule a comeback visit with Aisha for quite some time. And she was in the middle of moving across country to Oakland. And we made it happen, and we set the date. And once we set the date, we locked it in. And then the day of, she had to meet a deadline. So we did a quick one. This is relatively quick. When I have somebody like Aisha on the show, I like to talk to her for as long as I can. Like to talk to her for a long time and get some gems from her. But this one was shorter than I would have liked. And I know, since you all know her and love her, you probably would have wanted more, but this is all you get. So if you like this conversation, pester her on Twitter. Crafting My Style is her handle on Twitter. To say, we loved you, want you to come back on the show. She'll come back. But this is what you get. And I'm super excited that she was able to sit down and chat with me in the middle of her knocking out a deadline. And super excited to share this conversation that I had with the very lovely and talented Aisha Harris. Enjoy.
Yeah, so I spoke about it on Twitter, but yeah. I was supposed to get married last month in November. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to have like a big New Orleans wedding with all our friends and family. It was going to be great. And then, of course, the pandemic happened, and we realized pretty early on that we were going to have to basically not have it this year. There was no way, like, we didn't want to do a wedding with masks, and we definitely didn't want people traveling.
Right.
And, you know, just risking their health for us to have a giant party. So so that led us to canceling. And it also led us to finally telling our family and friends that we have actually been married for a while. Like a few years.
Oh, wow. Oh, a few years.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
All so, right. I mean, we were going to have, our biggest thing was just like, we wanted to have a big party with all of our closest friends to celebrate.
Sure.
You know, our relationship, but so thankfully my parents took it quite well, at least my family, most of my family did, and they were all happy for us, and you know, it's out of the bag, so
that's
now
great.
People know.
And you got a new job, and
yes.
This is the second new job that you had since you've been on, I think you were on in 2018.
Yeah. Well, the if that's the case, then yes. I can't remember if I had just moved to the Times last time we were on together, but
maybe you were. Yeah, maybe you were. Maybe you were already been. At the time. Yeah. Okay.
It could have been. Yeah. But I was at the Times for about a little over 2 years in the art section and then in the opinion section. And then as of September, I have been with NPR as a new co-host of Pop Culture Happy Hour. So
cool.
Fun times.
Yeah, that's great. You've said something that has always stuck with me. I won't say that I've just been crediting it to you, the term cautiously optimistic.
I don't think I'm the first person to say that at all, but it's definitely kind of the a thing I live by.
I mean, that's kind of how I feel about politics, how I feel about show business in a lot of regards, like when it comes to, you know, the shakeup with like that we had last with, you know, like, for instance, the show. What is this show? What's the Netflix show with the cartoon with the kids having sex?
Oh, Big Mouth.
Big Mouth. All the changes like that. I mean, it was like a kind of a race to make these changes, and then there's kind of like this stasis, but at the same time we're in a pandemic, so are we really seeing these changes happen? I mean, from my side, I feel like there is incremental progress, but I don't know.
Yes and no. I feel like we've already kind of moved on from George Floyd in some way.
Unfortunately,
it's definitely not top of everyone's mind. And obviously nothing can be forever. That's just not the way memory works. It's not the way things work. I do think that, like you said, it's going to be very incremental. There are going to be people who were changed by that summer, who were changed by those events. And, you know, I think on an individual level, I think it's more likely we're going to see more change than necessarily on a corporate level or like big business level, just because those sorts of things, those institutions are just way more harder to tackle and topple. And but the fact that we are still having conversations about defund the police and those sorts of things, I think makes me a little bit optimistic, just that they're still in the ether. We're still talking about these things. So
yeah,
I mean, I'm not holding my breath, but I also feel like there are small things and small wins that have been achieved. So
right. We'll see. More white people are involved. So then it seems some of them want to make a change, but sometimes it seems like even our white allies can be led astray. Like I went on a rant the latest episode that I did, talking about like just Dave Chappelle's Unforgiven and the critique that was coming from white people and white comedians in particular, saying that like because Dave Chappelle is considered to be a great comic, and I think he is, but you get Dave Chappelle's white counterparts don't get the same scrutiny as he does. And almost seems like he's peerless to some degree, but whatever. I don't know, where do you stand on that, like with regards to the way black art is critiqued? Are we slowly getting to the point where we can say, I didn't like it, it sucked? Or just as a pop culture critic, just as a writer, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I definitely think that we've gotten to the point now where you see more and more critiques and smart, thoughtful critiques. Mm-hmm. Of black art, in part because more outlets are giving black writers the opportunities to do so and are putting them in those positions. Now, not nearly enough, but it's happening.
Right.
You know, I can think of any number of people like Soraya McDonald and Angelica J. Bastien and like lots of thoughtful writers who are not afraid to, you know, say, well, I wasn't really digging this black art that some of y'all like to love or that like we're supposed to quote unquote like.
Is Soraya the one that did the Lovecraft thing? She hated it.
Yeah, she did. And I actually agreed with pretty much everything she said.
You didn't like it either.
I was not a, you know, like, I appreciated what it was trying to do, but it also felt to me like the fact that a syllabus existed already for this show before it had even aired in full.
Really? No, I didn't know that.
There's like an accompanying syllabus that the show itself, like the producers and creators, I believe, put out. I'm pretty sure HBO was behind it or the people behind it. Anyway, that sort of thing is just like, oh, like we are trying to, it's clearly supposed to be like quote unquote woke art. And we're in this era now where there's a lot of things like that, that don't really know what to do with their wokeness or can't do it in a necessarily artful or like in a way that makes sense. Like Lovecraft Country for me, the motivations of the characters were very muddled throughout. And I think there were some really strong aesthetic elements. I loved, you know, like the use of James Baldwin and like actual like spoken word and audio over specific scenes. Like I loved that aspect of it, but I thought the ending was terribly executed. And overall, I just think it was one of those shows that like, I'm not going to knock you if you love it and I will let you enjoy it. But I'm also not going to pretend that like, I think that it's good.
Well, I really loved it because of the, it was almost like, cause a lot of it's kind of based on pulp in a lot of ways and the horror genre where, and adding those elements to it just kind of made everything. I mean, it was almost sensory overload in a good way for me. Just like, this is really black. And if I like something, I'm going to dig in. I didn't even know they had that syllabus because there's a lot of shows that I like where I'll go, I'll look on YouTube, I'll look at theories, I'll read recaps, and I like hearing what other people say about it. I like, you know, talking about it. So, I mean, I didn't really see it that different from a Mad Men where, you know, you have a song that this song, if I look at Alan Sepinwall or say this song was blah, 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 blah. I'm like, oh, I'll listen to that. And oh, this adds to this. So I don't know. Maybe you guys got to see it before. Did you see all? Because I think her review was like five episodes, four or five.
I don't know. I could have sworn she wrote it after the whole series had ended. I could be wrong.
Somebody wrote something like four episodes in and then compared it to Antebellum, which I thought was unfair. That was her, right? I don't know.
It might have been. It's been a while since I read it.
Sure.
And I read a bunch of different critiques of it. So I might be mixing people up. But I think there's a difference between what you're describing with Mad Men, where it's like, because I think that it's one thing if the show is like, this is like recap culture, right? This is internet culture where like if something airs and everyone's talking about it, it's like the equivalent of the water cooler now.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, the next day people are going to blog like, oh, this song that was in this, that was on last night, like here's the backstory. You know, in my earlier days at Slate, I did a lot of those pieces. Like, here's an explainer of like what was happening. I think the difference with Lovecraft is that it just comes with this like sense of importance and this like you need to be watching this. This is like part of your homework and
Black people and, like, homework.
This expectation that like we're all supposed to love it just because it's dealing with all of these issues in a genre that we don't usually see. I think the bar is a little bit higher now. Like we can't just, I think it's great. Like I love the idea of subverting Lovecraft and using some of the tools that he used to promote white supremacy against him within this genre. But I also don't think it did so effectively most of the time. And it relied on a lot of like sort of hackneyed conventions, and it felt more like an anthology than like an actual connected story.
I think you're right though. Like I haven't read the book. I have the book. I just, I, you know, I haven't cracked it open yet, but I think it kind of it's almost like an amalgam of all those, like, and then there it wove stuff together towards the end.
And to me, like, the weaving at the end didn't work, like, you know, and it's but to all of that, like, I still think there are things that, like, I don't regret watching it. Mm-hmm. I think it's worth watching, especially if you are interested in this genre, if you're interested in, like, what Black art, what is happening in Black art now. Just like I would say, like, I mean, Antebellum is significantly worse than Lovecraft Country, in my estimation. Like, yeah. it has, like, more insidious intentions, perhaps unconsciously so, but at the same time, if you are a critic or if you really want to understand where we're at right now, I'm not going to say necessarily don't watch Antebellum, just, like, know what you're going into. And also, like, you know, just be aware. I mean, I'd love to talk about, like, I don't know. I loved P-Valley, which
I thought it was great.
It was so great. And not that they're at all the same, but I do think, you know, P-Valley is such an interesting, it is in the way that, like, Lovecraft was trying to, like, subvert the genre. I feel like P-Valley was taking a familiar genre. I mean, I don't know if stripper movie is necessarily a genre. It's like there's Showgirls and there's Hustlers. What else is there? I guess there's the Players Club.
Players Club, like, to me, it just seemed like if Players Club was a series, it was good.
Yeah, if Players Club was a series that was, like, super self-aware and, like, winking, like, it knows that it's a sudsy drama, and I think it's really, really well written, and the characters, while some of them are very extreme, like Uncle Clifford. At the same time, he's a very real character. He's grounded, and it doesn't resort to, I think there's just this pernicious stereotype. And obviously, yes, within Black communities, there is definitely still rampant homophobia. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But to see a show where, Uncle Clifford is, like, for the most part accepted by all the people around him and set in the rural South. I think it's just such a groundbreaking thing to see. Like, there is, you know, an underlying threat of, you know, things coming to a head when it comes to homophobia directed at him and directed at, what's his name? Lil Murda, who I also love. But at the same time, like, there's just so many moments where it could happen and then it doesn't. And I think it shows that, like, Black people can be and often are very accepting. Like, obviously there is homophobia. Yeah. It still persists. And there's a whole issue with Black masculinity that we don't have to get into.
Sure.
But to see it, see, like, Black queer love portrayed in this way in that environment is just so heartwarming. And I love it.
I think you're right. I think those two shows, they're different, but it's like you got HBO and then you got Stars, where, you know, before then it was Power. And then I think with HBO, it's like there's so much more expected. It's like, this is HBO and this show, there's Black people and you're going to like it, Black people. So you need to sit down and watch it and you're probably going to like it. But then there's going to be all this, like, the syllabus I did know about, but that.
Hold on. I want to make sure I'm not speaking out of turn here. I'm like 99% sure there was, like, maybe they didn't call it a syllabus, but I think they might have called it, like, it was some sort of, like, guide or something that they released every. Yeah. So.
You're more of an insider, though. I'm not gonna hold that again. This isn't an indictment on you because you didn't like it as much as me. It's just,
you, like, know, I just want to make sure my facts are correct. Yeah. I don't want to be, like, speaking out of turn.
Twitter will tell us.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. So I'm looking at it here now. Like, every episode of Lovecraft has a syllabus. This is
I could see
this is from Gizmodo, and it looks like. Okay, yeah. So it was from the Langston League, which is, like, an educational organization.
I just think that's cool, though. Like, if you wanted to know more, you could look it up, and it had people talking about, you know, Oklahoma, even though we got it, you know, with the Watchmen, even though that came out before, I think whatever. But it, I mean, how many Holocaust movies are there? But
it's true. Yeah, so yeah, this was an unofficial syllabus.
Oh, unofficial. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So why don't we just scratch everything I said about the syllabus?
No, it's okay. It's okay.
Either way, my point still stands, and I think there's this expectation that like we have to like, and this is a problem obviously not just with Black art, but like you were saying with like every piece of pop culture now, whether it's Game of Thrones or whatever, like you have to have like some sort of like complete guide breakdown of every intricate moment, and it's like sometimes I just find it exhausting.
Oh yeah, very much so. I can dig it. What has it been like for you this year, and when you consuming all of this media, and as you know, pre-COVID, like what was it? Like, what was? Can you compare the two? Like, what has it been extremely different?
I mean, it's been. I've definitely seen fewer movies than I usually do, or fewer new movies than I usually have. Although I've used this as an opportunity to catch up with a lot of movies that I'd always said I wanted/needed to see and then didn't have time for. So there's that. There's also this thing now that some movies are doing where they have like designated screening time. So instead of like going to a theater, like critics used to do to go see a screening. Now like Netflix has done this with a couple of movies. They have like events where you have to go online at a specific time and stream it. And then often they'll have like cast and crew or whatever show up and speak before or after. And to be honest, I don't really like those. I mean, like I don't mind designated appointment viewing if it's for like, if it requires that I have to leave my apartment or my house, because you know, that's what it is. But like now that we're all virtual, just give me the screener, let me watch it on my own leisure. it's just that's like a sort of nerdy critic thing and small potatoes. It's like there are far worse things happening during this pandemic. Seems stupid of me to complain about it.
No, but we know that we're talking the context of what we like to do and who we are as people. So I think people are smart enough to understand. Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely think, you know, I've watched a lot more TV.
What have you liked?
Although I was already watching a lot of TV. We already talked about P-Valley. I loved it. Obviously, I May Destroy You.
How heavy is that? That's a...
I mean, it's heavy.
Episode 3 or 4, when the guy gets sexually assaulted, I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Cause as a dude, it's like, okay. You're like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's not a show I recommend lightly.
Right.
Cause you never know where someone's coming from. But it is to me like the best new show of this year. Hands down, the way it ends, it's just so, she sticks the landing. It's so brilliant. It's just, it's right up there with like, I don't know. Well, I hate to make the Fleabag comparison because there are a lot of people like making comparisons
they're Brits.
To Fleabag.
Because what makes Brits Fleabag also look like a Disney movie? Like a after school, like it's.
Yeah. It's, but like.
Yeah. It's dark.
Yeah. And the fact that like it has a beginning, middle and end. And as far as I know, she has no plans to do to continue the story, I think is just, I'm all for creators, especially TV creators who are like, this is the story, I'm sticking with it. I hate it when people, when miniseries all of a sudden become, they're having a season 2.
Yeah,
Big Little Lies, really.
They didn't need it, they didn't need it.
No, season 2 is so terrible.
As much as I like those actresses, I just, you know, it's not. Yeah, it was good. It was good. One was good enough.
Exactly. So, I loved that. Another show I really enjoyed was Betty, which is on HBO. And it pretty much flew under the radar, which is why I've been like kind of trying to get people to watch it. Because I feel like
what's it about?
It's So it is 6 episodes. It's a short binge, half-hour episodes. It's about a group of female skaters in in New York.
Skate Kitchen was the movie that the
Crystal Moselle, it's based off of her feature film from a few years ago, and a couple of actually a lot of the skaters, and these are most of the stars were all skaters in real life, and most of them are also in this series, and it's just really it has a really distinct and like specific sense of place and time. And I watched it when, you know, we had only been in lockdown for a few weeks at that point. And it made me really nostalgic for New York already in those moments. And like, just going out, like being out all day and then, you know, running into someone and then winding up at a house party that afternoon on the roof for, you know, and it's a really interesting world that we don't usually see, which is women who are skaters trying to, you know, carve out their own space in this very male dominated world. And so I really loved it. I loved the sort of like naturalistic cinema verite sort of tone it takes. So yeah, I highly recommend Betty on HBO.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I just added it to my HBO Max list. And cause I did really enjoy the movie when that came out maybe 2 or 3 years ago, Skate Kitchen did, and then what's the mid-90s? Everybody was kind of talking about that, which I thought it was fine.
Oh, but, yeah, I forgot about mid-90s.
But when you make that compare, I thought it was okay, but when you make that comparison, I was like, no, this was the best skate movie. Skate Kitchen was the best skateboard movie of the year. You know, wait a minute, no, it wasn't. Minding the Gap, but that was a documentary.
Minding the Gap was fantastic.
So you can't count that. Like,
yeah. Did they all come out in the same year?
I believe so.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. I think they were 2018?
2018 ish, something like that. Yeah. Minding the Gap made me cry when that black kid was. That was something. That was, do you have, what do you think about the streaming sites? Who do you think is winning the streaming wars? Do you have an opinion on that? I'd like to think you would.
Clearly not Quibi.
No, not at all. No, they didn't.
It's not something I pay like terribly close attention to. Mm-hmm. Like I pay attention more generally to just like
the product itself.
Yeah, the product itself. I do think it's interesting that I just found out that Netflix is raising its price again after they just raised it last year.
How much?
I think my account is going up to $13.99.
Oh, that's not. I mean, we're gonna pay it. You're gonna pay.
I know, but still, I'm just like eventually. At this point, I have so many streaming sites that I'm basically paying what I would be for cable.
Yeah. So you cut the cord?
Oh, I cut the cord years ago. Oh, I haven't had cable in years.
Is your partner into sports?
He is, but he's not like, it's only basketball. So when basketball's not happening, he's not like watching anything.
That's what I always ask people. Cause it's like, I'm kind of afraid of it. Because I've had it for so long.
Well, so we have Hulu Live. So we can watch all the sports that way, and that's how he watches sports. And that's expensive. It's basic because it's, you know, it is basically cable, not that many channels, but enough. And I think actually they announced they might be going up again soon too. I could be wrong, but anyway, I have Hulu Live, I have Netflix, Criterion. What else do I have?
Do you have Disney?
Oh, HBO, Plus? Obviously. And Disney Plus.
That's the only one I don't have.
Yeah. I mean, I will say I get like, I'm able to, you know, expense a small sliver of that through my job. But, you know, most of these I'm paying for.
Yeah.
So I'm just like the rest of you all.
Yeah. the rest of you peasants. Sure. That's fine. I'll take it. Harris, she's just like us.
I didn't mean it to sound like that. I feel your pain.
Flex on us. It's fine.
How much we're spending, but you know what? Like as much, I don't need Criterion, but I do need Criterion just because, like, I feel like it is an educational, you know, thing of itself. I've watched so many movies there that I either never have heard of or, like, wouldn't be able to find anywhere else. Speaking of
Criterion, I did buy that Bamboozled Blu-ray. I think we talked about it like maybe, I don't know, maybe it was earlier this year or last summer, whenever it was announced. We were you and I kind of had a little back and forth about, are there any other Criterion movies with the exception of maybe like Killer of Sheep or Spike Lee?
Is Killer of Sheep on Criterion?
Is that the one did we talk about that?
I don't know. The Times actually a couple of months ago did a great piece, Kyle Buchanan and Reggie Ugwu. They both did a really well reported piece about the Criterion channel or the Criterion collection and why there are barely any Black people, Black directors, Black filmmakers. You know, off the top of my head, obviously Spike has Do the Right Thing and Bamboozled. I think those are his only two movies that are in there. Charles Burnett's To Sleep with Anger recently got an addition. Trying to think what else. But like there's some glaring omissions. Like there's no Barry Jenkins, yet somehow Lena Dunham has Tiny Furniture on there.
we need a Criterion of Medicine for Melancholy. With a proper director's commentary, with interviews with Wyatt and Tracy Hedgens. We need more because that movie, I'll go to my grave. It was just refreshing. It was just like that mumblecore, two people walking and talking about issues.
Yeah, great. I mean, Daughters of the Dust isn't there. Mm. Did I already say that? I might have.
No, you didn't.
Daughters of the Dust, Middle of Nowhere, Ava DuVernay's feature film before she made Before Selma. There's just so many Kathleen Collins, like all these Black filmmakers who are not on there. And, you know, as I recall, the Times piece, sort of the conclusion was just like the programmers and the overlords of Criterion were like, yeah, we got to do better. It's like, okay.
You got us. So, 15 years later, we'll get more.
Yeah. So hopefully.
I know we're under a time crunch. Do you have any, I want to shift to films that you've liked this year. Do you have any type of any films, any actors that you would consider for awards?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a weird year. Some of my favorites, and there's still a few that I have yet to see just because it's early December and it's like this is the crunch time when we're getting screeners for things. But some of my favorites were Time, which I saw at Sundance before everything before the world changed.
Who directed that one?
Garrett Bradley.
And what's that one about?
It's a film where she followed this woman whose husband has been in prison for
years. Oh yeah, I saw that. I saw the documentary.
Yeah.
Okay, you liked it.
Yeah. I loved it. Like
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. What were you gonna ask?
Because I watched it and I thought it was good, but I was like, y'all kind of brought this on yourself. I like that Still I Rise and all the beautiful stuff that, you know what I'm saying? All the stuff you're supposed to say.
Yeah.
But y'all robbed it. Prison system's fucked up, but like, yo.
I think the film does kind of, you know, offer, like the question is like, how long are you supposed to repent for? Like I think his prison sentence was for like well over a decade. And when you compare that to obviously all the white collar crime where you get like a slap on the wrist, obviously. I just thought like it does a really good job at like conveying emotionally what it is like to pass time and without a family member, a significant family member in their presence. So I loved that movie, Promising Young Woman, which I
want to see that. But let me say, let me tell you this though. It, with time, I felt like the grandmother, like her mom, like where she was just like, there was a couple scenes where she was just kind of like, she was like, I told her not to, you know, that's just, I felt like her throughout most of the film, but it's a beautiful film.
Look, I do not disagree that like they made some poor choices. But also, you know, sometimes if there's anything The Wire has taught me, it is that, you know, there are often, especially for, you know, people coming from a certain background, there are often, you know, reasons for it. They may not be good reasons, but like there is motivation there. And often it comes down to the system just being screwed.
Sure. Yeah, of course. Of course. And for the people that don't think I care about Black people, just know that all of this stuff, all the outside forces, all of that stuff is inherent. Like that, the prison system's bad, and the given circumstances that we are born into as Black people. But it was just something interesting that it was just like another wrinkle that you don't see in documentaries like that, where it's just kind of like, okay, I just felt, you know, all right. Give me some more that you liked.
Promising Young Woman is, loved it.
Carey Mulligan,
okay. In Emerald Fennell directed it. It's really one of those movies that I was not sure what to make of it going in, and there are twists and turns, and I think it's really, really smart and pretty much mostly pulls it all off. So, and Carey Mulligan is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think what else.
Seems like that's kind of like got a Hard Candy vibe to me. If you remember that.
The former
Ellen Page, now Elliot.
Yes.
Fantastic movie.
Yeah.
I'm excited for that one.
Yes. I'm trying to remember all the things that I've seen, and I'm putting together a list right now. Chadwick Boseman is fantastic in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. It, you know, even if he were still here, and obviously we all wish he was, but even if he were still here, I think the praise and the Oscar, you know, buzz would be there no matter what. This isn't like a sympathy, you know. Whatever.
That's a great role, because especially for him, because normally he's always this stoic guy, and Levy's kind of an asshole. That was in college. That was one of the first monologues that I worked on, like in an acting class. And that was like, August Wilson is like, he helped me see myself, and, you know, in theater and in art. So I know that's going to be a good role for him.
Yeah. It's really great. You know, it's difficult. It can be difficult to adapt a play to the screen. And I think George C. Wolfe, who's just like a master of the stage, is really good here, taking it and converting it for the screen too. So I really, really enjoyed it. First Cow, I really liked. Kelly Reichardt's film. It's, you know, it's very quiet.
She did that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's good. It's quiet, but it's also like really smart, and all of her films I think are very smart, but it's got like a little bit of humor underneath it, and this like really interesting friendship between two men in the wilderness in, you know, I think it's the 19th century, and it's just really, I don't know, it's fun. She manages to create a lot of tension around trying to milk a cow.
So it's a narrative. Like, it's a narrative. It's not okay.
Yep. It's a drama. It's a drama with some comedy in it. And I highly recommend it. I know it's streaming VOD now. So those are some of my, I can't, the last thing I will mention is 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Oh my God.
Rada Blank's feature debut. She wrote, directs, and stars in it. It is just I really liked it. We talked about it actually on Pop Culture Happy Hour. And it was, you know, really, really fun to see her in her element. It's one of those things where she really has a grasp. She's playing like a version of herself. Mm-hmm. But just all of the humor is really, really wry and quick. And the way in which she discusses Black art and how Black yes. art should receive, going back to the conversation we were having earlier, mm-hmm. You know, I think there's like a recurring theme where she's railing against the idea of poverty porn and white audiences wanting to yeah. see Black people only destitute. And I feel like that's sort of how I felt about Lovecraft Country. It's just
really?
Like, not in terms of poverty porn, but like, just like, I don't know, the way in which there's a lot of suffering in Lovecraft Country. And obviously it's set in like the 50s, but like, mm-hmm. I wasn't a fan of the Emmett Till. Like, I felt like he was used in a way that felt exploitative unintentionally, his death. And it just rubbed me the wrong way. And so anyway, to bring it back to 40-year-old version, I highly recommend it. It's on Netflix. Yeah. It is very fun. I love the interactions, like the dialogue she has with the students, the kids who play her mm-hmm. students.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I have worked with kids before of that age, of high school students, and that is exactly how they talk. They will just like fuck around with you, but also hopefully they admire you, or like at least like, you yeah. know, they want the best for you. So like that relationship just felt so, like the whole thing feels really grounded, but that especially, I was just like, oh man, like when one of her students, well, two of her students, but one of her students starts hitting on her, mm-hmm. like, it's just like, this is so inappropriate, but also this.
Well,
this
she can sit, it's the thing, like as an actor, even though something is wrong, it's that you kind of have to let it wash over you a little bit. And
yeah,
because that's the more interesting choice. Obviously, yeah. she wasn't going to do it, but like,
no.
That play at the end, that whole sequence was,
which felt like a subtle jab at Hamilton, or at least
subtle. No, that was ham-fisted.
Yeah,
that
ham-fisted. Was, yeah, I was trying to give her, you know, but I don't even know it was so much Hamilton as much as like how much white people love Hamilton.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what always rubbed me. I used to talk about it on stage. That's kind of what rubbed me the wrong way. It's like you hate on Ludacris, but you can use his music to sell, like, what is it? Pimping All Over the World to sell like a Buick. But Ludacris is bad.
I have this theory that in 5 to 10 years, there will be a bunch of upcoming rappers, most of them probably white, who cite Hamilton as their inspiration for discovering rap.
It would not be a surprise. But I think there's some real ones out, like that kid, Jack Harlow. I talk about it all the time. Like there's these white artists who seem to be sincere, like Moonchild, this soul band from L.A., and they're terrific. And they say, oh, we grew up listening to Erykah Badu and Common and the Root. So it's not like, I mean, they listen to us. It's you know, yeah, it is what it yeah. is. But I know exactly what you mean, though. You totally like, it's not going to be a surprise. Well, one more like one of your favorite things in media in 2020 as it currently stands on December 1st. The day
I don't
want to put you. I'll tell you mine.
Okay,
I'll tell you mine. Yeah. Maybe it'll get mine. My listeners know, and they're gonna roll their eyes. It is The Last of Us Part Two, which is a video game for the PlayStation 4.
I've heard about this game,
and it was life. It was one of the things that it was actually supposed to come out on my birthday, February 21st, but it got pushed back because of the virus, and ended up coming out in June. And I spent 4 days. I took 2 days off work, took the Friday off that it came out, took the Monday off of the following week, and just binged out on it, enjoyed it. It was awesome. It was like an amazing experience. So that was one of my favorite things.
I mean, I guess one of the things that I was happy I got to do was early on in the pandemic, my partner and I decided to watch the entire Fast and the Furious series in the proper order, which is not in the chronological order in terms of when they were released, but rather in terms of how the franchise has been retconned for various plot mechanics. We went through 1, 2, 4, 5, 6, back to 3, which is Tokyo, because, you know, I don't remember exactly what the reason was, but there were characters who died and came back, or died and might come back. Oh, wow. It's fuzzy. They retcon some shit. And then 7, 8, and someday. Oh, and Hobbs and Shaw, obviously. I'd already seen 7, 8 and Hobbs and Shaw in theaters. That was where I started my Fast and Furious, because my partner and a couple of our close friends are huge fans. So we've seen the last three in theaters. And so it was time for me to see the origins and how it all began, and watch the friendship between the frenemy friendship between Luda and Tyrese blossom from the earlier.
It's earlier fun, those points. Movies are fun. Those, they're, I mean, you know,
they are dumb.
You can't. It's undeniably fun. Well, Aisha, this has been. Oh, wait a minute. Can you give me? What was it like to travel across country during the pandemic? How was that? I saw some IG photos. What was that like? Was it fun? Was it?
I'd never done across country. So I don't know if listeners are aware, but I moved from New York to Oakland because couldn't do another winter during a pandemic in a small ass apartment in New York City. So we moved out here. And we did a road trip, and it was good. We saw some family in Chicago, stopped by, went to one. Because the ride from New York to Chicago is like super long, we stopped over for like literally just a few hours to sleep in Cleveland. And that's like, to me, that's the only reason I would ever go to Cleveland. I don't have family there. And
wow,
I don't.
It was fun. I did a comedy festival there. I had a great time, but yeah.
Yeah. So I went there. I hope no one from Cleveland yells at me. I'm from Connecticut. I know nowhere special. So.
Uh-oh.
Anyway, stopped in Cleveland. And here's a fun fact is that we were looking for a Walmart because I wanted to drop off a SodaStream thing because it was taking up space in our car. We had packed a bunch of shit. And long story short, I was looking for a Walmart, and I look on the map, the Google Maps, and it says the Christmas Story house is like literally 5 minutes away. I was like, what? We have to go. So we drove. I had no idea. I've seen Christmas Story like once, but I was like, this is a movie, like it's a landmark and it's right there. Yeah. So we went. We didn't go in it. They turned it into a museum. We didn't go inside, but like we parked and took a couple pictures, and that was it. So, yeah, that was not the highlight of my trip, but it was an interesting
part. That's cool. Yeah, it's the Christmas story. It's Christmas time. There you go. That's what they get. Yeah. Aisha Harris, you've always a pleasure to talk to you. And I will be bugging you to come back on in a few months. But this is always a pleasure. Thanks so much for doing it. Plug your show.
Yes, Pop Culture Happy Hour is on NPR. We just went daily, which means we can give you even more recommendations and even more discussions. We've broadened the amount of voices we bring on to the show to talk about these things. And yeah, it's a fun show. I love my co-hosts and my producers, and everyone should check it out if you want any recommendations for pop culture.
Great. Well, this has been so much fun. Thank you everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Take it easy.